Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Sarah Dykeman. She divides her time among seasonal amphibian research, outdoor education, and adventures. And we're talking about her book, Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201-Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. Sarah, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
Sarah, this seems like a crazy thing to do, but you've done long-distance bicycle adventures before, right?
I have. I have done a lot of bike touring. It's my favorite way to travel. It really slows you down so you can really see where you're visiting.
Is this the longest one you've ever done?
It's not my longest one. Right out of college, my friends and I, we decided we were going to bike to 49 states. That's every state but Hawaii.
So that's a funny thing. Did you have to crisscross back and forth?
We did a loop starting from California and ending in California that was very much not direct.
I have to imagine that, because you have to like go down and then over and up and to touch all the states.
Yeah, and then there was like states where it was like, sorry, you get like 15 or 20 miles, but we did actually have a goal to bike every state and also eat pizza in every state. So we tried to do justice to every part of the country.
Okay, I have to ask you this question then. Which state had the best pizza?
My favorite pizza was a pizza place in Utah that I can't remember the name, but it had good pizza.
Great. Well, let's talk about this project, because this was pretty wild. What pushed you over the edge to follow the butterflies' migration routes?
The monarch just kept calling to me. I didn't actually know a whole lot about the monarch before I started, but the more I learned, the more I knew that it was just the perfect traveling companion. They go about the same speed as a cyclist can go. You know, I tried to average about 60 miles a day, and when you take into account that I couldn't go in an exact straight line, or as you would say, as a butterfly flies, then we really did match our pace, and the monarch spreads out across North America, so I didn't have any route limitations, and they visit schools and farms and cities, so I just knew there was just so much possibility.
And you also set up a series of lectures along the way, which, first of all, that sounds like a nightmare just setting that up.
People are always like, you bike from Mexico? And I'm like, yeah, and the real hard part was that I was in a tent every night planning school visits and presentations, and people would say, hey, we want you to come to our school. And I'd say, it's a lot of work to make sure I'm there on the right day when I'm relying on my bike and my legs. And just being able to plan that far out was hard. That was the hardest part for sure. But it was worth it.
Yeah, I mean, it was an amazing series of events that you go through. It's all these little adventures along the way. And except for one bad event, generally you had really good interactions with strangers.
Yeah, I had such good interactions with strangers, and even the bad event wasn't all that bad, really. So I'm just so grateful that I was able to kind of get adopted by the people taking care of the monarch. And I really, you know, I feel like the event or the thing that bonded me most to their experience was not exactly the geography of our trips, but the fact that the people that were feeding me and housing me and spreading the word about my trip were the same people feeding the monarch and providing shelter for the monarch and telling the world about the monarch.
Well, before we go into what happened to you, let's talk about the monarch in general. The monarch is a migratory butterfly. Talk to me about its migration routes starting here in the United States.
So the monarchs that we see on the East Coast, the Eastern United States, that's pretty much from the Rocky Mountains to the Atlantic Ocean. They overwinter in Mexico, in two states in the southern bit of Mexico, Michoacán and the state of Mexico. And they fly north each spring where they lay their eggs, and then they die. But the eggs will metamorphose, and we call that the first generation. And the first generation will continue north, and it'll take 3 to 5 generations, but eventually the Monarchs will wind up back in Mexico in the fall to overwinter again.
That's amazing. You have to admire their DNA. That's their root is there in there.
Oh, yes. I mean, I had maps and I had internet and I had street signs and I still got lost. And then I'll be biking down the road and I'll see a little egg on a milkweed and say Indiana, and I'll just stare at it and be like, you are going to metamorphose and fly to Mexico, and you're probably going to beat me.
Well, let's talk about the importance of milkweed. Now, it's not just any one species of milkweed either. It could be any one of a number of species of milkweed, but milkweeds are critical to monarchs in migration and where they're going to lay their eggs.
Yes, yeah, so if you're a math person, it's milkweed equals monarchs, and no milkweed equals no monarchs. And milkweed is a really beautiful plant, and if you tear a leaf, this like milky latex sap oozes out, and it's most herbivores want to avoid it because of the toxin that it has. But the milkweed can actually eat the monarch can actually eat the milkweed when they're caterpillars, and then sequester or store that toxin in their bodies, rendering them poisonous and protected as well.
So the problem is, people are getting rid of milkweeds because people call them weeds. I read the book. Trust me, I read the book. but also the big problem is these monoculture farms, these huge agribusiness farms that get rid of all the weeds that are around the corn or whatever else they're planting. That gets rid of a huge resource too.
Right. One of the things I noticed most when I was biking was that we have forgotten how to share. Humans have forgotten how to share the planet, and that is hurting all involved. And corn and milkweed used to grow together. And In fact, I heard so many stories every single day, especially when I was in the Midwest, of, when I was a kid, I had to pull the milkweed from the cornfields. And just that, I heard that every day. And now you look out and there's just not a single bit of green besides corn. And we have to go back. This is not acceptable. It's not working. It's not giving anyone a future, especially the monarch. And we just have to share. And it's going to take all of us. We can't put the burden just on farmers. We all have to step up and say, we want more, we want better.
And it's not just the monarchs that are benefiting from this, but when you have these rows of native plants that are growing in between crops in a more natural setting, there's all sorts of pollinators that are benefiting from this too, and they are also suffering.
Yes, the monarchs and the bees and all the pollinators, frogs, all the creatures really are warning us. They're indicating to us, or why they're often called indicator species, that there's something wrong. And it's just a matter of time before we start to feel that in bigger ways and bigger ways. So we need to start listening, and we need to start reacting. And yeah.
On this huge journey, you got to tell me about what your bike was like.
My bike is a rock star. I actually looked it up because I bought the bike used from a little bike co-op. Well, I bought the frame and put it together with the help of a friend. But I looked it up. It was in a 1989 Specialized mountain bike steel frame, and it has has a lot of rust. I describe it as a scrapyard meets garage sale, but it gets the job done. And you don't need to have fancy things to go on trips. Really, you just need to have something that's comfortable and fits you. And my panniers or my bags, I have some fancier store bought ones that are extra waterproof for my computer and sleeping bag. But then my back ones were just old recycled kitty litter buckets, and they really got the job done.
Now, you slept rough, I think, almost most of the time. Was that a huge challenge, finding a place to sort of pull off the road and just do the night?
I started just pulling off the road when I was with friends in that 49-state trip, and it was just so liberating. You didn't have to have a plan. You didn't have to have money. You didn't have to have much of anything. You just had to kind of have a little bit of trust that there is a lot of pockets of earth that are inviting us to visit them. And one of the things I love most about this way of traveling Well, one is it really let me have or feel kind of the experience of a monarch, feel what it's like to not have great options every night, feel what it's like to have a really great option, like the perfect garden, as you will. And then it also really made me appreciate the small things. And I tell folks, like, the best nights of camping, like, I don't even mind if it was, like, a little sloped or real close to the road and kind of loud. If there was a tree that I could lean my bike against, that was, like, worth dancing about.
And you sort of scoff at no trespassing signs. Admit it. You wrote it in the book.
This freaks people out, and we have such a culture of no trespassing, but, like, I guess for me, it's like the planet is our home, and I'm being very respectful. I never made a fire, even, or left any litter. I left every spot better than I found it, and I think a lot of times we need to rethink our trespassing laws. I think, well, this farmer that I want to camp on their land, they're putting fertilizer into the water. They're, like, pretty much evicting all of the natives. And I speak of just a random farmer, not all farmers, of course. And so they're trespassing on my air and my water and my future. And I'm not allowed to camp. I'm not allowed to sleep there for a night. I think we need to reevaluate things.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Sarah Dykeman. She divides her time among seasonal amphibian research. I'd love to talk to you about that. I'm passionate about amphibians too. Outdoor education and adventures. And we're talking about her book. It's an incredible read. Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201-Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. Now, let's start down in the monarch sanctuaries in Mexico. There are four public locations. That means that they can be visited by tourists. And you spent a lot of time at El Rosario. Talk to me about what that area was like.
Right. It's the forest there is about 10,000 feet above sea level. And it's a mixture of pine trees and this fir tree called the Oyamel fir. And you have to buy a ticket and you have to have a guide, but then you walk up a bunch of stairs and you go through a meadow and then you come to this little section of forest and it changes year to year. But you look up and at first you're like, wait, what? And in the trees, what you'll see are thousands, if not millions, of monarchs clinging to branches.
Wow.
And the collective weight of the monarchs will bend the branches and sometimes even break them. And it's cold most of the winter, and that's important to the monarchs because the monarchs go there because if they stayed in the U.S., it would be too cold. They would freeze. But by going to Mexico, they find this cold forest. It is rather cold, that where they can hang from the trees, not use any of their fat because they're not flying around, and almost hibernate all winter. It's not exactly the same, but it's similar. And then in the spring, it starts to warm up, and the monarchs start to warm up, and they start to fly around, and that's just glorious. So you'll just be standing there, and a sun ray will hit a cluster of monarchs, and they'll start to warm them up, and they'll stretch their wings. And then, like, in a second, they'll all just pour. They'll explode from the tree and circle around, and you can close your eyes and hear their wings flapping.
Now, are the monarchs safe in these sanctuaries? Or is there still extensive illegal logging?
There is logging as long as there are people that need to put food on the table. That will be the case. Where we really want tourism to kind of start to take the center stage in Mexico to provide those sorts of jobs so that people don't have to rely on the trees, but. You know, the important thing to me and the thing that the monarch reminds me every day is that the problems and the challenges of the monarchs aren't Mexican. They're not Canadian. They're not American, United States problems. They're North American problems. And so they're going to take North American solutions. And we are a team. And so I always just tell folks, like, plant milkweed. Just do your part, and we'll ask everyone to do their part, and that's all we can do.
Now, you were talking about milkweed, and there are many different species of milkweeds, but there's a foreign milkweed that's somewhat controversial?
Right. There are a lot of species of milkweed, and the monarchs will eat quite a bit of them. Each species of milkweed has a different amount of toxin in it. And so monarchs usually, they kind of prefer the ones that are more toxic a lot of the time. And one of those species is tropical milkweed. And so they'll actually, the monarchs will prefer it. But there's a whole balancing game in nature, right? And there's consequences to planting this tropical milkweed that's not native. And so I kind of stay out of the biggest controversy. I think if people are planting milkweed, let them plant milkweed. But I do always stress to people, if you can plant natives, do that. It's just everything has already worked itself out over millennia. So why should we not invite the natives to do the work that we need them to do?
Exactly. I want to give a shout out to Brianda Cruz Gonzalez.
Brianda?
Yeah, there's a lot of neat people that you met along your trip. And she was there in the beginning, and they give you a place to stay and really sort of welcomed you in?
Yes. Brianda is like a sister to me at this point, and her mom is a second mom to me. Her mom's name is Leticia, and Brianda graciously and bravely invited me to stay at her house, and I took her up on the offer. One of the things about bike touring that I love, especially when you don't have a plan, is that you can say yes to things a lot easier.
That's right. Okay.
And so when she invited me, I said yes, of course. And I stayed at her house. I planted beans on her and her family farm, which was so fun. I practiced terrible Spanish, made terrible mistakes. Not terrible mistakes. I made hilarious mistakes. And I've actually gone back and stayed with them multiple winters now. And I was at Brianda's wedding, and I'm so grateful to the Monarchs for kind of bringing us together.
Now, when did you finally set off north from Mexico, from the Monarch Reserves?
I left in mid-March, and I kind of left a bunch of times because there were different colonies. So I'd leave, and then I'd get to the next one, and I'd be like, oh boy, I've got things I need to do here, places to see, people to meet. But about mid-March, I left, and I got to the United States the beginning of April. And I finished back my trip at the end of November. So I was actually about 4 weeks behind the main migration by the time I got to Mexico, or the colonies.
Now, along the way, there was a whole series of people that you met who were people who were part of the solution, I would say. Can you just talk about how you sort of worked out that network?
The network found me, that is for sure. I did not know that this passionate team existed. I mean, I knew people cared about the Monarch, and I knew people were doing things to support the Monarch, but what I didn't know is that they were such a team, they were so connected. And so what would happen is one person would find out about my trip, and it would spread very quickly. And soon I was getting emails from all over North America inviting me to stay and present at their school or present
very
at their
cool.
nature center. And I would do my best. I mean, it would be silly not to say yes to these invitations. I was more of a matter of could my legs get me there.
Let's talk about the life cycle of the monarch. So the female is laying eggs on milkweed. What do the eggs look like?
They look like little cream-colored footballs. And the monarch, a female can lay around about 500 eggs, and about 1% of those will survive. So sometimes I'd give presentations at schools, and I'd count 1% of you guys. That would be like, there was a crowd of 300, you know, I'd be like, that's three. Which three of you would survive? And everyone would raise their hands. But the females, they don't want to lay 500 eggs on one milkweed because monarchs are eating machines as caterpillars. And so they try and you'll usually find about one per plant, ideally, and they often lay them on the underside of the leaf. So you have to really slow down and flip over leaves to find what you're looking for.
I think monarch chrysalises are magical looking. They're really amazing looking. Can you describe them?
The chrysalis, it changes over the course of the time of the chrysalis, but it starts out this like emerald green, and it's got these little gems of gold and black on them.
Yeah.
And they're very well camouflaged. The caterpillar will usually crawl off the milkweed and find a safe spot for their chrysalis, because at that point they're more helpless than ever. But they're not helpless, but they'll crawl off. And then as they start to transform, the emerald will become translucent, and you'll start to see the inside. You'll start to see the wings of the butterfly. You'll see the black and the orange.
Wow.
And it's extraordinary.
Now, I want to talk about Dr. Lincoln Bauer, who's one of the leading monarch biologists. And he answered a really important question that I'm sure people in the audience are thinking right now. Why save the monarchs? Who cares about a butterfly? And I'm setting you up for this. I know it's important, but I'm asking you to answer the question. I just want you to know that.
I know. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to answer this, because people do ask it all the time. And for me, the answer is so much. So, of course, I usually give people the answer that they want, which is, you know, they're important for the ecosystems, right? They're pollinating flowers. They're all those eggs that are getting eaten by spiders and bugs of all sorts are important for the food chain. But for me, it's like I have an answer that I think sits closer to my heart, which is the monarch is an ambassador of nature, and the monarch is a guide and a teacher. So it's so easy to fall in love with a bright orange butterfly, right? And then you want to learn more. And it's like the monarch is holding your hand and saying, come this way and back into nature. And you start looking for caterpillars. And you find a caterpillar, and then you find all the other creatures that rely on that same plot of land.
That's right.
And you, since you're looking closely and you're slowing down, you see all the details and you see all the beauty. You see the googly-eyed spider in a new light. And I really, truly believe that the monarch is how we get there. And so I see the monarchs as our teachers, and we need all the teachers we can get in 2021.
Now, one of the things I appreciate about your writing, and it obviously reflects yourself too, is you get pissed off.
Yes.
Unapologetically pissed off. Now, I thought I was a grumpy about the environment, and I am 95% of the time. But then I read you and I realized, wow, here's another person who's as grumpy about the environment as I am. You don't back down about what you think about stuff. And I love that.
We can't back down.
I know that. I know that. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. And I started writing a book. I gave my presentation to kids. I talked to almost 9,000 kids on my trip. And so I started my book for them. And about halfway through, I was like, I didn't realize how much anger was in me. Like, I can't do this yet. And I'm actually working on a book for kids now about the trip. But this first adult book was just, it was just saying all the things that were in my, that were heavy in my heart. And the whole book is not, I don't think, is super depressing. I think
No.
For every bit of anger, there's a little bit of hope. And that's the only way I can cope. But yeah, there's tough truths that we need to reckon with, and I'll tell you what, it's really depressing to hear those truths if you're not planting milkweed or if you're not doing something to help a creature in the world, help the planet. But if you're helping, then it just riles you up, I think, and reminds you that you're not alone, that this isn't just one person's fight. This is all of our fights, and we're in it together.
Good for you. And I also want to mention, I love the name you have for this, Butter Biking.
Yes.
I hope that gets common usage, because that's a great word.
Well, in my presentations to kids, I'd always start by saying, don't worry, my bike is not made of butter. Because they would ask that. And I realized quickly that I wasn't in the marketing department of anything, because I don't think a professional would have chosen that name. It takes a lot of explaining, but the gist is, I can't fly like a butterfly, but I can bike like a butter biker.
Now, just before we go, I have to ask this for my own benefit, because I'm passionate about herps. I appreciate the fact that you mentioned a lot of the herps you helped across the road as you went.
Well, first you have to explain what a herp is.
It's an amphibian or a reptile. And for people, I do birds. I'm a huge birder, but I will never lose my original passion for herps. And whenever I can, I will help a giant snapping turtle cross the road, a snake, no matter where I am in the world.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. But I want to thank you for what is the coolest herp that you saw on the trip?
I love the animals that are kind of common that people can see everywhere. So my favorite animal and my favorite herp out here in California is the Sierra tree frog, or coarse frog as it's sometimes called.
Yeah.
And they're everywhere. And then on my trip, I always tell the kids the cutest animal I saw was an American toad on the road. And like a toad, if you've never looked at one closely, they have like this like so much attitude in their face. Like
their eyes are amazing. Their eyes are incredible.
Yeah, they're exactly that too. And they just look at you like, what are you up to? And I just like held this little American toad that I found and put him off the road. But I think the herp I was most excited about was a rough green snake. I don't ever get tired of seeing rough green snakes.
Well, you know, they've virtually disappeared from here in Massachusetts. I grew up with seeing lots of smooth green snakes, but in the last 20, 30 years, they've become incredibly rare, and they think it might be due to loss of habitat. No surprise.
Right, and that's the great thing. If snakes aren't your cup of tea, save and protect and fight for another species, because everyone is connected. So if you are helping monarchs, you're helping all these other animals that you might not even know about.
So what can the average person do?
It's such a great question, because we can all do something, and it's gonna vary a little bit, but everyone can plant gardens wherever you are. It doesn't matter. I saw monarchs in Texas. I saw monarchs in farmlands and backyard gardens, school gardens. I saw a monarch in New York City.
Yep.
We just have to plant native gardens. We have to return the prairie or return native lands back to the plants and animals. And of course, just be their voice. Like, I can't talk to everyone, you can't talk to everyone, but together we can talk to a lot of people and spread the word that we need to share, and we need to prioritize more than just humans, because our future is at stake.
And with that, I will say goodnight. My guest tonight has been Sarah Dykeman. She divides her time among seasonal amphibian research, outdoor education, I love this, adventures. And we're talking about her book, which is an adventure, Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201-Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migrations. It's a great read. Sarah, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. This is fun.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.